We're going to have to probably push ahead. It looks like we may have some people filtering in here, but when you hold a conference in South Florida and everybody's had 4 months of no sunshine and it's a gorgeous day outside, we do what we do, but you know, there are temptations, and so I understand that. Small but vibrant group here. We're talking about nutrition and cancer. A little story. Herman, the senior citizen, lays dying on his deathbed of cancer. And he looks up at his wife, and she's holding his hand. And he says, "Honey, you've been with me through this whole cancer bout. And years ago, you were with me through that whole heart disease thing, a heart attack and rehabilitation. And years before that, you were with me when I had my car accident. It was years of rehabilitation. And years before that, there you were when our house burnt down. We were together." He says, "Honey, I think you're bad luck for me." Too many people in America think cancer is nothing more than bad luck. And we're about to talk about that. I don't think it's bad luck. Maybe 5% of it's genetics, maybe 95% of it's lifestyle, and we'll get into that before we're through. Since nobody's introducing me, actually my agent was supposed to be here to introduce me, but he's still being held without bail, so I'll have to do my own introduction. In addition to earning my bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degrees in nutrition, I'm a registered dietitian, a certified nutrition specialist with the American College of Nutrition. I've taught college nutrition. I've written 15 books. My 10 years as a vice president of nutrition for cancer treatment centers is what really put me in the, somewhat of an expert in this field. And then I organized 3 international symposia on the subject of adjuvant nutrition and cancer treatment, and edited a textbook on the subject and wrote a book on the subject, Beating Cancer with Nutrition. You folks were given the audio CD in your information, your registration packet, so you have a little information there. And I was a grant reviewer for the National Institutes of Health on the subject of alternative medicine and nutrition and cancer. I was a grant reviewer for the U.S. Army Breast Cancer Research Project. And so a few people think that I'm an expert, and I guess I bring that up because the field of nutrition and cancer is so highly controversial. And you may ask the question first, why should we believe you when there are other people who have some diametrically opposed viewpoints? So I hope you'll have some credence in what I have to say. And then there's about 900 references in my book that hopefully support it even further. More importantly, this stuff works in patients. And so if all I was doing is scanning the Medline literature and writing a book, that would be one level. But I've worked with thousands of cancer patients over the past 13 years and have found that this is very applicable. And if you fall asleep in the next few minutes, here's the sound bites. Number one, as I said right up here, a healthy human body is self-regulating and self-repairing. And you say, "You mean I came all the way from Seattle to hear that?" This is a very important soundbite, because how does the body heal? There is this innate, miraculous collection of mechanisms that allow us to heal from a cut, a broken bone. How do you get through the flu? Is there any drug that will beat a viral infection? Not really. How did you beat most of the bacterial infections you had? You did it. Something inside of you. How do we beat cancer? And before we're through here, we're going to realize that all of us are getting cancer all of the time, and that there are innate mechanisms that allow us to prevent and even reverse cancer. And so the job of nutrition is to upregulate these natural, endogenous, biochemical, and physiological mechanisms that are there and have been since the dawn of time. First sound bite is right there. Second one is, a well-nourished cancer patient can better manage and beat the disease. Now what that says is, nutrition is not sole therapy against cancer. I would not tell someone who has stage 4 colon cancer mets to the liver to have a glass of carrot juice and call it a day. It's a lot more complicated than that. But nutrition will improve quality and quantity of life and chances for a complete remission, and it reduces the toxicity of medical therapy. And what I find happening too often in America is the oncologist tells the patient, don't take those nutrients. Number one, they're expensive urine. And number two, they're going to reduce the effectiveness of my chemo and radiation. And then the nutritionist tells the patient, don't take that poison because it's just going to kill you. When in fact, if the two of them, the oncologist and the nutritionist, are willing to work together, they can come up with a synergistic effect, and the nutrition will help prevent the collateral damage. We're in the midst of wartime right now. We hear this all the time. Collateral damage is when our people get hurt in Iraq. We can minimize the collateral damage in the cancer patient from chemo and radiation while the oncologist and nutritionist look like heroes. And so I'm saying you don't have to choose one or the other. Oftentimes the patient is like a child in a custody battle. Mother says, don't go with your father, he's an idiot. And the father says, don't go with your mother, she's just a runaround. And the kid is the one who gets hurt in this, and the patient gets hurt. And so I'm looking for some cooperation, some synergism. All right. Push ahead here. So where are we headed? We're going to look at a well-nourished cancer patient. We're going to have less cachexia, fewer side effects, nourish host defense mechanisms, reduce risk for future cancers, improve quality and quantity of life, chances for a complete remission. Well-nourished comes from food and supplements. You have in your handout my presentation, and so if you look on page 253 and beyond, you'll find the slides almost exactly as I have them up here. When they ask you to send them in 2 months early, what can you say? You know, there's a certain amount of the molecules get re-jumbled inside the computer, and actually what happens is I come up with more material, and so it's a little different. This is myself, my tiny little garden in Carlsbad, trying to do what I practice what I preach, and I think it's important. If I can't follow the advice, I wouldn't tell anybody else to do it. Use nutrition in the beginning of your therapy, not as a therapy of last resort. They say that time is a great healer, if only you had more of it. And what I find too common in cancer and nutrition in this country is patient gets cancer. They were a little blood in their stools, a lump in the breast, painful urination. They go to their doc. The doc sends them to an oncologist, a radiation therapist. If that stuff doesn't work, they end up darn close to being in hospice, maybe about ready to have the body bag zipped up, and then they say, wait a minute, nutrition. Why didn't I think of that? That's what we'll do. And so way too many patients who start thinking about nutrition are in stage, and I would like it to be much earlier in their diagnosis. Cancer in a host as a seed in a soil. Once again, this is a simple but powerful concept. This came from, now this is not a misprint. Stephen Paget, an MD, wrote in Lancet in 1889, cancer metastasis involves a complicated biochemical conversation between the seed and the soil. Now let's think about that. Bruce Ames, a professor at UC Berkeley, has then said, a deficiency of vitamins or minerals appears to mimic radiation in damaging DNA, causing premature aging and cancer. We move down here and look at this model. Cancer is the seed. There is a conversation between the seed and the soil. The soil is the host or the patient. And what we have done for the past 30 years and $50 billion in the war on cancer is focus almost all of our energies on the seed. If we can kill the seed, we can cure the cancer. But we ignore the conversation and the host or the soil. And now we have from MD Anderson a Dr. Fidler saying the time has come to put major emphasis on the soil. And so in the next few minutes, we're going to talk about the soil, the patient. There are many conflicts in the nutrition field, and I have found that this little chart helps to explain all of them. You ever hear, you know, you've got Dr. Atkins said, eat all fat and meat you want and you won't get sick. And Dr. Dean Ornish is over here saying, don't eat any fat or meat and you'll get well. And some people get well on both diets, but neither has 100% recovery rate. And some people said, stay out of the sun, it's toxic. And others people have said, well, I think vitamin D is good for you, and eggs are killing us. No, they're good for you. What are you supposed to do? Think about this, folks. In all of life, there is what's called the adaptive forces of nature. Hang in there with me. Reaction from the organism and time in eons. What we have is, for instance, the first and worst pollutant on the planet Earth was oxygen. Biologists tell us maybe 4 billion years ago there were these single-celled organisms, and then from that evolved blue-green algae. And from blue-green algae we have photosynthesis, and the urine from photosynthesis, the toxic byproduct is oxygen. And oxygen is a potent free radical, and it killed everything around it until eventually organisms started figuring out how to adapt. And they developed antioxidant mechanisms. So oxygen in the beginning was toxic. Then it became tolerated. And now for aerobic organisms, it is essential. Follow the same thing with sunlight. Sunlight is ionizing free radicals. It is a little bit of Chernobyl. It is a little bit of Hiroshima. It is a wicked, cancer-causing substance. And in fact, in the beginning, it was toxic, then tolerated, and now it is essential. Gut flora. We've got trillions of microorganisms in our gut. Any one of them can leak into your bloodstream and kill you, septicemia. But what we find now is a whole field called dysbiosis or probiotics and the whole business of having a healthy collection of microbes in the gut. So initially these bacteria were toxic, then tolerated, and now essential. They make vitamins. They help us with digestion. They compete with pathogenic organisms. And on it goes. So if you have a problem looking at eggs, sunlight, meat, all those things, say, what did the organism adapt for? What's it supposed to get over the course of thousands of years, of eons? And then everything falls into place. And for me, the most important book to make all of this stuff rational was from Weston Price, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. Written by a dentist, 1940, still in print. You can get it on Amazon. If you want to figure out how does all this stuff work, what he said is that the book's Nutrition and Physical Degeneration by Weston Price, written in 1940 by a dentist. What he said is he went around the world, he and his wife, a nurse, and they visited 12 cultures on 5 continents, and they found across the board, it didn't matter what people ate, as long as they ate their native indigenous diet in an unrefined form, they had good health. They had no cancer, no heart disease, no schizophrenia. They had solid bones, good teeth, until they started drifting into the refined processed diet. So it's a good book that helps make sense out of a lot of this nonsense that's in the press. All right. Quick overview, and before we do this, I think it's very valuable for me to get a feeling for the audience. How many of you people are healthcare professionals? You are working with patients, almost everybody. How many are MDs, medical doctors? How many are DCs, doctor of chiropractic? How many are NDs, naturopathic doctor? How many are dietitians? How many are pharmacists? Good rich mixture. Who am I leaving out? Practitioners, nurse practitioners, PAs, there's many other valuable people of the healthcare team. Excellent. And all of you are working with cancer patients? Is that a... Okay, well, many of you. Excellent. What I'm hoping we can do is have some slides and time at the end for questions, and then you'll all get about to getting down to South Beach and watching the NCAA games tonight. So I'll try and keep you on time. We are in the midst of a cancer epidemic. It's the second leading cause of death in the U.S. It's the most expensive disease to treat, although Alzheimer's and diabetes are giving it a run for its money right now. 7 million Americans currently in remission, approximately 8 million being treated for cancer today, 1.4 million newly diagnosed, excluding skin cancers, and we've spent a lot of money in the war on cancer, and we still have an increase in the incidence and death rate. And that could be argued, people talk about earlier diagnosis, there's all kinds of ways of tweaking the statistics, but suffice it to say, we spent $50 billion and we ain't got no magic bullets. We need better therapies. 42% of Americans living today will develop cancer in their lifetime, and it's somewhat of a J-shaped curve. It's a higher incidence in neonates. It drops down dramatically during adolescence and the 20s and 30s, and then it starts skyrocketing. And you find that two-thirds of cancer patients are over age 65. Breast cancer, a 250% increase in breast cancer since 1950. Globally, it's another big deal, 6 million deaths per year right now. We find that the big cancers are prostate, lung, colon, and breast are the primary. That's about 80% of all cancers in America. Number one killer is lung. Number one in incidence are breast and prostate, respectively, for men or women. I was fortunate enough to work, as I said, for 10 years with Cancer Treatment Centers of America, and this is the facility in Tulsa, Oklahoma. This is the old City of Faith from Oral Roberts. So we had this 30-story tower. They're building a new building now. And this is the facility in Zion, Illinois. It's a $20 million state-of-the-art building, bone marrow transplant, stem cell, IMRT, which is intensity modulated radiation therapy, fractionated chemo, intra-arterial infusions. So the finest of traditional oncology coupled with nutrition, naturopathic care, detoxification, psychology, et cetera. So I think a good marriage of integrative cancer treatment. Misconceptions among oncologists. Number one, nutrition has nothing to do with cancer. Well, in fact, the health of all animals and plants is heavily dependent on nutrition. And I have a little comparison here. How many of you are pet lovers? How many have got a dog, cat, bird, horse? No, your husband isn't a pet. I didn't ask for that. What we're looking at is, how well do we feed our pets? Pretty well. I've got two labels here. You all are very good label readers, and you know that you ingredients are listed in descending order of prevalence. And so label one, the first ingredient is sugar. The second is white flour. Next is high fructose corn syrup, which is sugar. Then it's corn syrup, which is more sugar. Water, cocoa, gelatin, baking soda, corn starch, chocolate, salt. That's food number one. Food number two is ground yellow corn, soybean meal, meat and bone meal, beef tallow preserved with mixed tocopherols of vitamin E, corn gluten meal, ground wheat, a long list of vitamins and minerals, garlic oil it's got, Bruges yeast it's got. Second one is dog food. The first one is snack wells. And you think, how is it that a veterinarian spends 4 years in medicine studying nutrition as part of their therapies, although vets are starting to lose interest in nutrition because it's not very profitable? There's a lot of surgery and drugs that's going on in vets now. Anyway, the farmer knows it, the veterinarian knows it, the pet lover knows it, that what you feed your pet has a great deal to do with their health, their longevity, their ability to recover from any ailment. How is it that nutrition is irrelevant in humans? We're just another organism, perhaps more vulnerable than a cockroach or a rat, and that's one of the reasons why we have our cancer epidemic. So, the first statement is false. Next one, antioxidants are both expensive urine and will neutralize the benefits of chemo and radiation. Then why are the antioxidant drugs, amifostine, which is given for cisplatinum, mesna, which is given for ifosfamide, and dextrazosone, which is given for Adria, used with chemo? If it's a drug and it's an antioxidant, it's okay. But if it's a nutrient and an antioxidant, it has a different effect? Not true. So physicians are quick to prescribe antioxidant drugs, but then wonder about nutrients. Another one, sugar has nothing to do with cancer outcome. Then why do we spend $1.5 million on a PET scan, stands for positron emission tomography, and what we do is, in that process, we inject radioactively labeled glucose into the patient, and then we scan their body because the cancer sucks up that sugar preferentially, and we use this Geiger counter-like device to find that's where the cancer is, because cancer is an obligate glucose metabolizer. And the same technician and doctor and dietitian who did that therapy then walk away from the table and say, but eat whatever you want. Milkshake's good enough, you're losing weight. I don't think so. So, what do I consider comprehensive cancer treatment? And there are some doctors in this country doing a great job, including Dr. Rashid Buttar over here in the yellow shirt, a real technician, a mechanic. What he is doing and what a few others are doing is, number one, change the underlying cause of the disease, which is a complex process. Number two, restrain tumor debulking. Chemo, radiation, and surgery have their place. Brzezinski's got his anti-neoplastons, hyperthermia, photocytotherapy, herbal zaphoresis, and then symptom management. What do you do about pain, nausea, anorexia, anemia, etc.? So it's a three-legged stool that allows us to give maximum bang for the buck. Etiology for most diseases. Pull the weed out by the root. If we agree that etiology means underlying cause, and if we agree that no one with a headache is suffering from a deficiency of aspirin, and no one with breast cancer has a deficiency of Adriamycin or tamoxifen, then we start looking at, well, how did they get it? Well, we have diagnosed diseases, and we have, in America, you'll be diagnosed, classified, and given one of these numbers for an ICD-9 billing code. And then we open up a protocol book and we say, well, stage 3B breast cancer, all get leucovorin, FUDR, and subsequent radiation is adjuvant therapy. They all get that. Well, what if we asked, how did you get the cancer? And we find in comprehensive healing modalities, secondary etiology. Among the underlying causes are infections, and I'll come back to this, folks. Inflammation, hypercoagulability, dysbiosis, hypothyroidism, maldigestion, immune dysfunction, hyperglycemia, elevated blood sugar, allergies, hormone imbalances, oxidative stress, and acidosis. And these are primarily driven by these primary etiology, which is nutrition, infections, exercise, attitude, toxins, energy alignment, and genetic vulnerability, all crucial. And I am a nutritionist, but let me stop here for a second and talk about attitude. I think that there, if I had to summarize cancer treatment in my humble opinion, it's like a clam shell. We're here by the ocean. Think about the upper shell is metaphysical, meta meaning above, meaning things we can't shake, weigh, and measure, meaning love, sense of purpose, compassion, people who have got a reason to live. There is a metaphysical protection. Below it is physical, and that's nutrition, exercise, avoidance of toxins, energy alignment as in chiropractic manipulation. These are all physical. So if you put that together, our host defenses are almost bulletproof. And what happens in too many of us is that the clam is wide open and vulnerable. And so looking at the business of attitude, worked with many patients, and I find that many cancer patients date 1 to 2 years back to the diagnosis of their cancer, and you have some traumatic event. And while all of you are brilliant people helping cancer patients, make sure you include the psychoneuroimmunology as part of your therapies. Ask them what happened a year or two prior to your cancer. For instance, patient came to us with laryngeal cancer. This gentleman was 42. It's a very rare cancer, very bright guy. His doctor back home had done a laryngectomy, carved out his larynx. It was metastasizing, spreading. He came to us, we gave him a full court press, everything we could think of. It was still spreading. And I asked him, what happened to you a year or two prior to the onset of your cancer? And he said, funny thing you would ask, my wife left me. I said, really, was it a good marriage? He said, I thought so. And as a matter of fact, on the night she left, she told me, there's nothing you can say that will make me stay. And he got cancer of the SABOX. And I could go on and on with examples of not just getting cancer as part of a stress reaction, but where you get cancer, maybe some related event. So don't ignore the spiritual side of cancer. It's very crucial. All right, and we're going to dive into nutrition in some detail. So what is actually happening here, folks? This is a little snippet from a movie by Disney called Never Cry Wolf. What's happening here is this biologist is sent up to the Great North, and he's told, we need to find out what's happening to the caribou. This is a true story, a beautiful movie, Never Cry Wolf. So they drop him off in the middle of the Never Never, and he follows the wolves for the whole summer, and he finds they're not killing any caribou. They're eating mice. They're scavengers. And when they finally did chase a caribou herd, what they did is they ran down and killed which of the caribou? The sickest and the slowest and the weakest, exactly. And that's what I think is happening in cancer in our body. What happens is your cells are full of toxins, inadequately nourished, stress, lack of energy and vitality, 60 trillion cells that hum and vibrate with a certain level of vitality from various things, the physical and metaphysical. And as that vitality drops off, opportunistic infections step in and begin to deplete host defense mechanisms. And so what he found here is the wolves chased down the caribou herd. They killed one, the sickest, the slowest, the weakest. And he went out and broke open the rib of this animal and found out it had leukemia. Essentially, the wolves were thinning the herd. They were doing it a favor. What's cancer doing in our human body? Think about this in America. In America, we consider gravy a beverage. 60% of us are overweight. We have 500 times the heavy metal content of our ancestors from a more pristine era. I'm talking lead, mercury, cadmium, aluminum, arsenic. We have 1,300 identifiable chemicals in the average municipal water supply, most of which we have no concept of their toxicity or their synergistic toxicity. The only exercise we get in America is coughing or chewing. And you add all that stuff together and you say, I'm surprised the wolves aren't getting more of us. It's only 42%. So, to try and sum this stuff up, you as the healthcare practitioner, what I tell patients is, you need to start thinking about training for an athletic event. You're not just beating cancer. You're not going to lay on the couch like you take your car to the mechanic and say, Doc, I'm going to be in the back having a cigarette while you fix the car, okay? That's the way we think of medicine, is that, you know, the doctor is going to fix me and I can do whatever I want. Tell the patient, you are training for an athletic event. You have to build your vitality so full of wellness that there's no room for illness. And that's a big part of cancer recovery. And then you get people like Dr. Buttar who can add auxiliary therapies to that. Surveillance theory of cancer. This is very important, folks, because we have known for many years that if we knock out the immune system, people have a dramatic increase in the incidence of cancer. And the fact is that the theory says that the average adult gets about 6 bouts of cancer in a lifetime, but only 1 out of 3 Americans ends up in a cancer hospital with an identifiable neoplasm. The other 2/3 got cancer but beat it. And what we're trying to do here is try to resuscitate those non-specific host defense mechanisms that are fighting cancer all day, every day. So we find immunosuppressive drugs increase cancer incidence after a kidney transplant. There's an enormous increase in skin cancers after transplant. Far greater incidence of benign breast disease after transplant. DNA adducts, according to Bruce Ames, each cell is getting about 1,000 to 10,000 cancer, potentially cancer-causing hits per day per cell. Now we're down here in hurricane country. I want you to think about this. You're up on your roof and there's a hurricane 200 miles an hour and it's tearing shingles off at the rate of 1,000 to 10,000 shingles per day, and you have to put the shingles on exactly right or you get cancer. And that's what's happening in the human body. It's amazing that it happens at all. And it's amazing that 2/3 of us manage to beat cancer. And what we're looking for is to keep those systems going. So nutritional status influences non-specific host defense mechanisms. Once cancer is diagnosed, we need to debulk the tumor while resuscitating these defense mechanisms with optimal nutrition. That means the immune system, plus cell-to-cell communication, plus apoptosis, which is programmed cell death, plus angiogenesis, which is the making of new blood vessels that go into a tumor. The body has the ability to shut that down. Plus tumor encapsulation. The body says, I don't like this thing. I want to get rid of it. Can't get rid of it. I'm going to wall it off. For instance, in breast augmentation, most plastic surgeons will tell you that eventually those breast implants harden. The body says, I didn't want this thing here. It's not my DNA. So it tries to wall it off with collagen or calcium. And the body will do the same thing with the tumor, given the opportunity. DNA repair, back to that repairing the shingles, and many others which equal host defense mechanisms. Health state of the union is pretty pathetic. We spend $1.4 trillion a year. $1 out of $7 in our gross domestic product is spent on health care. And for that, we are 37th in the world, according to the World Health Organization, for our health care system. So we have a little cartoon. What do you mean you're out of breath? I haven't switched it on yet. You've worked with these people, haven't you? Increasing incidence of cancer in America. Some people say it's because of our aging population. It has nothing to do with nutrition. Here's the percentage of population over age 65. Here's the increasing death rate from cancer, and those two are not parallel. There's more to it than just an aging population. Progress report in the war on cancer. Many medical oncologists recommend chemotherapy for virtually any tumor with a hopefulness undiscouraged by almost invariable failure. This is from a board-certified oncologist as published in Lancet. There are other similar reports, but this Abel says a chemotherapy is effective in about 3% of advanced epithelial cancers. Lance Armstrong recovered. Testicular cancer responds nicely to chemotherapy. Wonderful. God bless him. I'm glad. However, that may not apply to the other 97% of the people who are getting chemotherapy. And in spite of this data, chemo, radiation, and surgery are the only reimbursable cancer therapies in the U.S., and in fact, in California, the only legal. If you use anything but that, you're subject to a fine and 2-year imprisonment. And so they'll say nutrition reduces the effectiveness of chemo and radiation therapy. Wait a minute. Sometimes the only exercise I get is smacking myself in the forehead here. Where is the effectiveness of chemotherapy? So what does that make me think of? I think about Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz when she came to the wizard and said, we want the promise you gave us. And so what exactly did they do? So what I'm sharing with you is we need to add more therapies, more modalities to cancer treatment. 30 years ago, Nixon promised us a cure for cancer. We don't have it. And we spent a lot of money on it. And we need to expand our horizons and look at other therapies, including nutrition. You never get the right answer if you're asking the wrong question. Instead of asking, how can we kill more cancer cells, maybe ask, why does cancer grow here? How can we change the environment in the patient to discourage cancer growth? And how can we make the patient healthier? How do we heal? Florence Nightingale, founder of modern nursing, said, nature alone cures. Hippocrates, father of modern medicine, natural forces within us are the true healers. And I think there is this interesting debate between Bichamp and Pasteur, both of which said, the germ is nothing, the terrain is everything. The cancer is somewhat irrelevant. The terrain is crucial. So, shifting the cancer paradigm, what are the oncologists thinking about this? Do we have any oncologists in here? I'm not being critical of the group. I'm hopefully, we're not going to tar and feather you. Nobody's going to get out a lynching rope. I hope we have none, okay. Well, the idea is that if we had some, the oncologists themselves are rethinking their model. This is from the Journal of Clinical Oncology. Shifting the cancer paradigm, must we kill to cure? These people say the limits of the cancer-killing model have been reached. And at the bottom here, they talk about conventional anti-neoplastic approaches will play a role as debulkers. The strategy will change to one of re-regulation, in other words, nutrition. And what I'm hoping someday in the near future is oncologists say, we can do some debulking, we just don't want to kill the patient. We can give them some CoQ so we don't have cardiotoxicity. We can give them some vitamin E and selenium so we don't kill the kidneys. We can make sure that they have adequate nutrition so they don't die from malnutrition. And that we can do some debulking while we re-regulate the system, reset the switch, so those host defense mechanisms are working. So you know we need better health care when the only doctor who makes house calls is that Kevorkian fella. Poor Jack. I think he's still in prison, isn't he? So, a little quick introduction here. The San Diego Wild Animal Park. They have a world-class veterinary hospital. It's a $20 million, 60,000 square foot, state-of-the-art facility. They have a surgical suite that any doc in this room would admire, and it's state-of-the-art. If you want to do a tracheotomy in an elephant, they can do it. They got the winch to get it in there. These animals are, many of them are exotic and endangered, and what do? They spend a great deal of time studying the animals' nutrient requirements. If it takes live grub worms or whatever it takes to help the animal recover, nutrition is a big part of that process. So, with that in mind, what is our ancestral diet? This was work done by Shostak, Eaton, and Connor, published in New England Journal of Medicine and later in a book. What they found is our ancestors ate a diet of about 33% of the calories from protein, about 12% is what we're getting today. So the red bar is them, as in our ancestors. That's the factory specification. The yellow bar is us, as in what we're doing today. Sugar. We get 20% of our calories from sugar. They got none. Fat, we get 42%. Now it's down to 39%. They got 21%. Does any of this stuff start looking like the zone diet? And so what I think about is, what did our ancestors eat? The zone, the paleo, the protein power, a lot of these things have morsels of truth in them. And what they're saying is, we want to eat a diet of roughly 20 to 33% calories from protein. We want to eat almost no sugar. We want to get about 20, 25% of the calories from the right fats. And if you add all this up, fiber, we get 20 grams of fiber. Our ancestors got 50 to 100 grams. And the true piece of trivia, the most commonly shoplifted item in American pharmacies today is Preparation H. That's because we're a constipated nation. So you look at the red bar and the yellow bar, they're not even close. If you bought a factory specification diesel truck and you put gasoline in it, it won't run right. Theirs was about zero. Ours is about 19%.
What about fruit?
Fruit is fructose primarily. Yeah, but the amount that they were eating, the percentage of calories in the diet was still very low.
The glycemic index is much lower.
What you find is when you eat an apple, the glycemic load, the glycemic index is very different than having a Coke. So it's injecting sugar into the bloodstream versus time-release food, which is what nature gives us. Most popular grocery items in America, read them and weep, folks. Marlboro cigarettes is number one. Winston is down at the bottom there. None of these are paragons of nutrient density. So we get a little cartoon. Eat your rice. Think of the millions of Americans eating nothing but junk food. Now we approach the subject of, can you really reverse cancer? This is heresy. This is actual blasphemy to think that you can reverse cancer. The oncologists still think that once it's cancerous, it will always be cancerous and you have to kill it. But in fact, there is a reversal process that is possible. For instance, we find cancer is like a ball rolling downhill through three phases: initiation, promotion, and progression. As it nears the bottom, it gathers momentum and it becomes more difficult to reverse. But the body has mechanisms built in to help reverse that or stop it, slow it down. These are like flippers on a pinball machine. I'm really dating myself there, but if you can think of that. And that health is a deterioration, a continuum from anaplasia, metaplasia, dysplasia into finally cancer and then spreading of cancer throughout the body. But up here, we have things that are very common, slightly abnormal cells. And we know that nutrients like indole-3-carbinol has been able to reverse cervical intraepithelial neoplasia. Vitamin E can reverse fibrocystic breast disease, which doubles the risk for breast cancer. Folate can reverse bronchial metaplasia and cervical dysplasia. Vitamin A can reverse oral leukoplakia. These are all pre-malignant abnormal cells, and nutrients in the beginning phase can reverse these. Indole-3-carbinol, I'm going to start fast-forwarding because we've got some these slides are in your handout. Vitamins prevent colon cancer? The answer is yes. This is a study with patients who had endoscopic polyp removal. They were given vitamin A, E, and C was the vitamin group, or lactulose, which is an interesting thing we could talk about. It's a prebiotic. Or no therapy. The group that had no therapy, there was 36% of them that came back with another polyp occurrence. In the vitamin group, only 6% had a polyp recurrence. If this was a drug, this would have been headlines in USA. Stock prices would have exploded. Exposure. Is sun exposure good for us? This is an interesting point. We're in South Florida. There are many people that have been told for the last 30 years, hide from the sun. The sun is damaging. Put on your SPF 30. No, make it 45. Never mind that. Put on a plastic sack over you so that you don't get any sun. Too much sun in fair skin in a malnourished body will generate cataracts, macular degeneration, basal and squamous cell cancer. True. But what we're looking for is a tan, not a burn. And there's clear evidence showing that low intake of vitamin D because of inadequate sun exposure is generating about 30,000 cases of breast cancer per year. Just vitamin D. And so what we find is, well, what about melanoma, doc? You know, I mean, that's a very dangerous cancer. Do you know the profession that has the lowest incidence of melanoma is outdoor construction workers? Look it up. And the few patients that I've worked with who had melanoma on strange spots in between the toes, sometimes on the bottom of the foot. You say, where's the sunburn there? It's immune suppression, it's vitamin D deficiency, and actually new data showing it's a legume deficiency. Beans are good for you. Legumes actually have protease inhibitors that probably have some merit. Protease inhibitors and proteases, there's a neat balance between those two. We can talk about that in the Q&A if you want. Is nutrition support safe? Well, everything's got a risk to it, folks. Face it, life is a sexually transmitted fatal disease. We know that tobacco kills 400,000 people a year, alcohol 125,000, prescription drugs somewhere between 100,000 and 140,000. That's from the on-label use of prescription medication. And we walk down this level and we found auto accidents, 42,000. My favorite is hair dryers. 17 people die every year by using a hair dryer while standing in the bathtub. We've got to get a law passed to get these hair dryers banned. I don't know about you. And down at the bottom, we got all vitamin supplements, zero. This is data from the Center for Disease Control, National Centers for Health Statistics, JAMA, etc. We're not killing people with vitamins. Now, you can do some damage if you have contaminated tryptophan, if you have a heart condition and you're taking excessive amounts of ephedra, you can do some damage. There's a window of efficacy here we have to respect. First, do no harm. Drugs have a more narrow window of efficacy. And the difference between a medicine and a poison is dosage. Use some good judgment here. However, you can overdose anything. You're eating too much fiber. Dr. Buttar, you ever have any patients who you say, I want you to eat some fiber, and they come back and say, Doc, I got to use a bath towel to clean myself afterwards. This is ugly. All right, we're going to prioritize and try and hop, skip, and a jump through this so we can get through it. Five main reasons why anyone would use nutrition as part of comprehensive cancer treatment. First, numero uno, to prevent or reverse malnutrition. 40% or more of cancer patients die of malnutrition, not of the cancer. Number two is immune augmentation. We talked about the importance of the immune system. It's the cops and it's the garbage department. It shoots the bad guys and it takes out the trash. If it's working right in quantity and quality, it will control cancer. Number three, protection from the toxic side effects of oncology, chemo and radiation. Number four, selectively starve the tumor. That is, cancer is an obligate glucose metabolizer. And number five is anti-proliferative factors, meaning nutrients become biological response modifiers. And this is where you say, what do you mean by that? We're getting, every year about August and September, there's roughly 10 to 30 football players who die from heat stroke. It's 90, 100 degrees, they get two practices a day. What's heat stroke? What is it? It's a deficiency of water, it's dehydration. If you give someone with heat stroke water, suddenly water becomes a life-saving drug. It's a biological response modifier. And what I find is that many cancer patients are so deficient in EPA, fish oil, in zinc, in selenium, chromium, in a variety of phytochemicals, that it's like pouring water down the throat of a dying football player who's got heat stroke. Suddenly they prop up and you've saved their life.
This ends side one. Please.